Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema Rewind. This is Rob Lamb.
And this is Joe McCormick, and we're out today, but we're bringing you a classic from the vaults. This was one of the early episodes of Weird House we did. This is the episode on the Ewoks movie, Battle for Endor.
Yeah, this is a super fun film for Star Wars fans and non-fans alike. I will say that in this episode, I at one point refer to the fact that the movie is unavailable on Disney Plus, and I say, well, I just hope that they add it in the future. Well, we are in the future, and I can tell you it is definitely on Disney Plus. So if you need to watch this film, that is the place to go and do so.
It's a life day miracle.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. My name is Rob Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today, we're getting into that Star Wars, gunk. I got a question. We were sort of chatting about this before we hit record today, and I feel like we've got to recreate this moment. I was wondering, you remember when The Force Awakens came out, and there were some Star Wars fans who were very angry about various things. One of the things they seemed that some people were angry about was that I believe the people who now owned the rights to all the Lucas Star Wars properties had declared that a bunch of extended universe stuff, so a lot of the Star Wars books and all that, was no longer canon. It didn't really happen in the Star Wars universe. And what I'm now wondering is, were they also angry that the events of the Ewoks movies didn't happen? Or were there people who were like just furious spamming the internet with spoilers for the movie because like Wilford Brimley didn't really live in that hut in the woods, and the beaver teeth Ewok creature didn't really run in fast forward and all that.
Teek, you mean Teek, Joe?
Teek.
Don't act like you don't know Teek's name.
Well, I was confused about Teek because it sounds in the movie like they're calling him Teek, but when I looked him up on the internet, people were calling him things like Teej, like his name had a J in it. So I'm very confused now. But you're right. My ears heard Teek.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, he's Teek to me. And I guess that comes down to my feelings about canon in Star Wars, which I think I've expressed here before. It's like I'm kind of like, build your own canon, you know? You know, for the purposes of enjoying it all, like just accept what you want and you know, be happy about it. But
I have to have a corporation tell me what really happened in the Star Wars universe.
You know, I mean, I can see where it's valuable for storytelling purposes, and I understand why they did it, why they took the multi-tiered Lucas canon system where it's like, you know, A-class canon and B, like the film we're discussing today, I think was technically C canon. Okay. And instead Disney came in and just said, all right, we got canon and we got legends. And canon is what is, you know, the official story that we're building new stuff off of. But of course, they often go back into legends and draw things out, pick out characters and events and weapons and things like that, and bring them in, bring them back into the fold. And so, I feel like there's not too much to get upset about, but I try to be more easygoing with the Star Wars universe.
Well, obviously, C in C canon stands for cool as hell, because this movie is really, really cool.
Yeah, and it's fitting that we're recording this shortly before Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. because after we picked it, I realized, this was the thing. Like, this came out on Thanksgiving or for the Thanksgiving holiday on ABC television back in the 80s, back in 1985. So, really, we're partaking of a holiday tradition right now.
Right. So once again, like last week with Boggy Creek 2 and The Legend Continues, we're covering a sequel colon subtitle film without covering the original. So the movie we're talking about today is the made-for-TV Star Wars movie Ewoks colon The Battle for Endor. But that's actually a sequel to another Ewoks movie. I don't think I've seen this other one.
Yeah, I mean, I can give you the very brief rundown of the first one, Caravan of Courage, which came out the year before, 84, on ABC television around Thanksgiving. And it had a pretty simple plot. Basically, it followed Sindel, that's the little girl, the little, like, super blonde Shirley Temple-like girl that is in both movies, followed her and her family in their adventures after they crash-landed on the forest moon of Endor. Endor, for those of you who don't remember, is, of course, the pivotal location in the second half of The Return of the Jedi. This is where the Empire puts their shield generator to protect the second Death Star that they're constructing.
Wait, sorry. So this is a moon, right? This is not a planet. It's a moon of a planet.
Right. Yeah. Basically, Endor is a gas giant, and this is a habitable moon, like a hella habitable moon. It's lush. But anyway, they crash there. I think there has always been some confusion about whether these films take place before or after Return of the Jedi. Like, I think they're sort of supposed to be taking place before. But then there are questions like, well, how does Wicket already know English or basic or whatever you're calling it, you know, or does he forget it and then have to learn it again from Princess Leia? But at any rate, on one end or the other of Return of the Jedi, this occurs. They crash there. The parents are kidnapped by a giant creature called a Gorox, which is actually something that that McQuarrie designed for Return of the Jedi, but it didn't get used. It's like a giant ogre thing.
Oh, Ralph McQuarrie, who we talked about in Boggy Creek? Wow. Yeah. Connections again, man.
Yeah. So basically, the Ewoks and the kids have to go on a journey to save their parents from this monster. They pull it off, and that's the movie. It's fun. It's a fun little film. But that is all you need to know for this one.
Now, if that is the aliens of the Ewoks canon, Battle for Endor is the Alien 3 of the Ewoks canon, because it starts off basically killing all of the beloved characters from the previous film.
Yes, it does. Like, basically, it starts off with the family hanging out with the Ewoks, getting their ship ready to go so they can leave Endor. And then a bunch of marauders show up, these humanoid warlike creatures with battered, like, just, you know, their blasters are just held together with, like, dirty gauze and dirt, you know. They come and they raid the village. They take Ewoks and the human children hostage, and all of Sindel's family, except for her, are killed by the marauders. So it's just really a brutal start to a kid's movie.
Do you like Paul Gleason? I hope not, because he dies in the first few minutes.
Yeah, and it's interesting, Paul Gleason didn't play the dad in the first one, so he was cast in the role. Paul Gleason, for those of you who don't remember, he was the principal in The Breakfast Club. That was like his big role. He was in some other things too, but yeah, he's in it for just a very short stretch, and then he's dead.
Classic jerk authority figure of 80s movies.
Yeah.
But the movie also, so the movie, it sort of begins like Alien 3. It kills all the beloved characters from the previous film. But then it also sort of begins like Conan the Barbarian, because it starts with basically Space Thulsa Doom just raiding an Ewok village and then taking a bunch of prisoners. Even some of the shots look kind of similar, though in a slightly cheaper and less dramatic, less Wagnerian way. I was thinking about how the bad guys in this, I like that the look of them is kind of simultaneously like skeletal orangutan, but it's also sort of insectoid, right? They've got faces that are a cross between like an ant and an ape.
Yeah, these the Marauders have, I think, ultimately an interesting character design. In later works, I think they are also referred to as the Saniassins. That's supposedly their species, but in here they're the Marauders. We'll probably just keep referring to them as the Marauders. But yeah, they're a little bit apey, a little bit reptilian. They ultimately make for really cool space orcs. You can think of them as space orcs.
I guess that works. Well, wait, maybe before we get too deep into the plot, I'm sorry if I threw off the sequence here. Maybe we should give the elevator pitch and look at some trailer audio, a little bit of background, and then we can fully break down what happens in this beautiful adventure.
All right. Well, here's the pitch. A young girl loses her family to brutal space marauders and a witch forest moon of Endor. We'll get into the witch in a minute. She teams up with a tribe of Ewoks, an old hermit, and a rabbit-like speed demon creature to survive. Or if you'd rather, you can look at it the other way and say this is a movie about a grumpy old man who rediscovers his zest for life thanks to a little girl and her two stuffed animal friends in space.
In space. It is Wilford Brimley on the dank moon of Endor.
Yes.
Let's hit that trailer audio.
Somewhere at the end of the galaxy, two friends were about to say goodbye.
What's wrong?
Shh, danger.
Until the forces of evil threatened their lives.
Don't look back, just run fast, run.
And together, they face an incredible adventure beyond imagination.
There's no escape for you, my little one.
Must have hope, must escape.
All right. I like how we got some roars in there, because there are a lot of creatures to roar in this film.
Yeah. Oh, there's some really good, big, nasty creatures that are ridden like Hannibal's elephants, but they look more like Tyrannosaurus Rex tadpoles. You know what I mean?
Yeah, the blurgs. Yeah.
Oh, is that what they're called?
Yeah. Yeah, they're a lot of fun, because this is an example. We were talking about things that were rejected from canon and then brought back in, because this was the blurgs show up in this film for the first time. And yeah, they're big T-Rex guppy mounts that the Marauders are using. They would later be brought back in the Clone Wars series, and then they were brought back in the first season of The Mandalorian. Huh. So they effectively made their jump back into live-action Star Wars in canon.
Okay, I want to know how this thing got made. Ewoks: The Battle for Endor. So this came out after the original trilogy, right? It came out after Return of the Jedi.
Right.
That's okay. So the whole original trilogy had already been released. Fans are already familiar with the dank forest moon of Endor. They're already familiar with the Ewoks, the cuties, space bears. How do we get to this? Was George Lucas involved at all?
Yeah, like he was definitely behind it. I believe he is the story credit on both of these films. And I'm not privy to the full breakdown or the full Wikipedia entry on how it came to be. But I mean, basically, this was an attempt to continue dipping into the Star Wars universe, specifically Endor and the Ewoks, by telling smaller stories with them. In a way, like, that's the same brilliance. Well, I don't know if it's brilliance here, but I would say that the brilliance that you see in The Mandalorian, where they're like, let's tell smaller stories in this universe. Like, this is a big universe with a lot of cool stuff in it. Let's carve out a smaller area and tell something there.
Sure. I mean, that's a great way to expand on a setting and a world you've created. That's very nice. You don't always have to be blowing up whole planets. You could just have like a little spy story set within that universe, or a Western.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in this case, it's Conan the Barbarian set in that universe.
Conan the Barbarian for kids, set in that universe. Yeah. It's, and again, I think it also is important, you know, that, yeah, there's room enough to tell not only different size stories, but stories with different audiences in mind. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, like, the Star Wars universe is vast enough. You can tell the story of Rogue One, which is, you know, I think more of a spy story and war story for older fans, set in the universe. And then you can tell this story, which is skewing a lot younger.
Yeah. Rogue One's more like John le Carré in space. And this is, this is Conan the Barbarian meets E.T., but a little bit cheaper in space.
Yeah. Now, one thing I want to drive home about these films, especially for anyone out there who maybe isn't my age or older, you have to realize that, okay, this came out in 85. That's 1 year after the Caravan of Courage movie that we just mentioned, 2 years after Return of the Jedi. And there would not be another Star Wars movie on TV or in cinemas for 14 years. Yeah. So to put that another way, three Star Wars movies come out before the two ABC television Ewok films, but nine films came out afterwards as of this recording. So if you're my age, these films were just not things you could ignore. These at the time comprised 40% of the Star Wars cinematic experience. So that's one of, and also, as our producer Seth brought up, like, they were on TV. So there's a good chance that you or someone you knew taped them. So suddenly it is a repeatable experience. And I'm certainly one of those kids who definitely had repeat viewings of The Battle for Endor. I probably saw it more than I saw Empire or Jedi growing up.
Wow. So did you also have the thing where it had certain commercials that had been taped along with it, and you just memorized those commercials, like the holiday special with the Lady Garment Workers Union commercial and Tobor?
I don't remember it. So maybe we were savvy and edited those out. I don't know. Or I mean, I can't imagine they actually presented it without commercials at the time. But I don't remember the commercials. I think I would, because I fondly remember some taped VHS commercials.
Okay, so we're living in a world where this is 40% of Star Wars canon, or at least C canon or whatever he's calling it. So who actually directed this thing?
So it's a team, two brothers, directors and writers here, Jim and Ken Wheat. And there's some fun connections with these two, because they had previously worked with Graydon Clark on his 1980 film The Return. They wrote the screenplay for that.
I haven't seen that, but no. if The Uninvited is any indication, Graydon Clark is somebody whose career is worth exploring.
A couple of other films that they wrote the screenplay for or involved in the evolution of the screenplay writing were A Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Master, and The Fly 2.
Oh, wait a second. So The Uninvited, I forgot, Graydon Clark directed Without Warning, the first Roadhouse Cinema movie we did. That completely slipped my mind. I'm sorry.
Yeah, everything comes back to Graydon Clark.
I apologize.
He's the Alpha and the Omega.
He is.
So those are two notable films, definitely not kids' films. But then another, they also wrote a screenplay titled Nightfall that went on to become a film called Pitch Black. So anytime you watch a Riddick movie, you will see their names in the credit because they were involved in the original screenplay.
Oh, that's really funny. You know, I wouldn't say Pitch Black is a great film, but when I actually went back and watched it, it was much better than I was expecting. It has plenty of charms that still hold up.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of some of the cuts and the edits and the it feels very to me anyway. It feels like music videos of that time.
Yes, yeah.
In a way that can be jarring. But that being said, I think it's a solid space monster movie. With a little maybe the machismo is ratcheted up to a level that is not my go-to level.
Right.
But I enjoyed it.
But it also is an early indication. You get that glimmer of why Vin Diesel would turn out to be such a big movie star. I mean, he's just imminently lovable, even when he's playing a really bad dude.
Yeah. And of course, the cool thing about Riddick too is, I mean, the first film it was Pitch Black was a necessary precursor to Chronicles of Riddick, which, as you know, is my favorite Vin Diesel film.
I know your love of Chronicles of Riddick. We actually watched this one together, and what are they called? The Necromongers in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wear the bone armor. They look kind of like space Kurgans.
It's really good.
But okay, we've been burying the lead here. Okay, so the really important thing about this movie, personnel wise, is the big WB, Wilford Brimley.
Yes, that's right. Wilford Brimley plays his character Noah in it. This is the grumpy old man that is key to the film. Brimley is interesting casting in this, and it's kind of weird to think about Brimley as a cinematic icon, because when you think of him, you think of oatmeal, you think of cowboy hats, you think of these rugged everyman roles, perhaps.
I think of The Thing.
That's the thing. Well, that is the thing here is that I feel like I mostly know him from the big science fiction films that he was in, namely John Carpenter's The Thing, but also he was in Cocoon. Mm-hmm. He was in some horror movies here and there as well. And granted, he had some huge roles in some totally non-weird films like Sidney Pollack's The Absence of Malice, for example. He's really great in that.
He's in The Firm. He plays like a bad henchman for the evil lawyers.
Yeah, so it's weird. He's great at playing like a rural, grumpy rural dude, or like a grumpy lawyer dude. Like, it's weird how a character actor will fit two molds that in real life are maybe a little further removed. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But in this, he's clearly intended to be some sort of Heidi's grandfather sort of character, a grumpy old man whose heart is melted by a little kid. Mm-hmm. And this is interesting, he's the rare Star Wars character who wears spectacles.
Oh, I did not think of that. That's an interesting point.
Yeah.
Is there another? No one comes to mind.
No, I mean, there are characters that sometimes wear strange goggles and whatnot, you know, sort of sci-fi goggles. But in terms of someone who's just straight up wearing glasses, I can't think of one offhand. No.
It's like a class of two. It's Wilford Brimley and Maz Kanata.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe there's some extended universe stuff where his eyes, because the thing is, his character is stranded on the planet as well. We come to learn that he and his buddy, Sarek, crash landed on Endor some unspecified number of years ago. Uh-huh. Like, it seems like maybe like 20, 25 years, maybe. maybe in that time, his eyesight went bad and he had to like find like ancient ruins on Endor and find eyeglasses that had been constructed by a long dead civilization.
Right.
I don't know. Or maybe he just wore eyeglasses. I don't know.
In the pyramids of Endor, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so you say he's like a Heidi's grandpa kind of character. He absolutely is that. But I would say the actual closer analogy within the Star Wars universe, and this is going to sound strange at first, but he's the Han Solo character in this movie. He's the person who is initially gruff and grumpy and self-interested, but comes through in the end because he made friends and he saves the day.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. Yeah, he's kind of the Han Solo, an older, rounder Han Solo, mm-hmm. But certainly he has that generalist flair rather than, he's not a specialist. I would think if he was a Dungeons and Dragons character, his class would be Action Grandpa.
Uh-huh.
Because, he's good at just fixing stuff and tinkering with stuff, but he's also really good with a walking stick and a grappling hook gun.
That's right. So he's a walking stick guy, but then at the end he busts out some real martial arts.
Yeah, he's able to hold his own against an alien warlord that seems to be about 8 feet tall. So, he can come through in a pinch.
Now, this movie also has, we mentioned, I guess this might be the only character that is carried over from the actual films. It has Wicket the Ewok, who,
yep.
I don't mean to be mean about this movie because I did really enjoy it. And, you know, I'm sure it's great for kids and all that, but something looks a little bit wrong with Wicket in this movie. In Return of the Jedi, Wicket the Ewok is cute. In this movie, he has Manson family eyes. I'm not sure exactly what's different. I guess it's the same costume, but he has this terrifying blank stare that I don't recall from Return of the Jedi.
Huh. I don't know. I didn't pick up on that as much in this, but
beep 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 beep, we have an incoming message from Seth has knowledge we don't have about Wicket eyes.
Guys, I'm very, very, very sorry to interrupt, but I know this just from watching too many documentaries about the many small changes that have taken place in the updated versions of all the Star Wars movies, you know? One of the big things they did for Return of the Jedi was... No, I'm sorry. Is that even the right name of that movie? Which one's the third movie?
Return of the Jedi?
Yeah, Return of the Jedi. You got it.
I'm glad I have those correct in my head. Return of the Jedi, one of the big changes they made was they went in and very subtly made all of the Ewoks' eyes less creepy. They gave them very subtle blinks. They gave them life. So they weren't actually looking like little buttons. So Joe, this is fascinating to me because you might actually have a vision of the special editions updated in your mind.
Oh, no.
Where their eyes look less creepy. When in reality, maybe this version of Wicket is the true version of Wicket.
Oh
this
my
is,
God.
This is what we actually knew, perhaps back in the 80s, pre-special editions. I don't know, though.
Oh, thank you, Seth. Well, now I consider myself just fully shamed because I'm on record not... Well, then again, I don't like a lot of the stuff they did in the remasters, but a lot of the changes they made, for example, in Empire are good, you know, like the new Wampa and all that. That's good stuff. So maybe this is one of the good ones, too.
Could be.
Well, yeah, if it's done right, you wouldn't notice, right? And so this is one where you don't notice. So makes sense.
But is Wicket in this movie still Warwick Davis?
Yeah, it's totally Warwick Davis. Warwick Davis is Wicket and always will be. But it is interesting to watch him in this film knowing it's Warwick Davis because in when he's playing Wicket, there's really not much to the role, right? I mean, it's a physical role. You know, he's doing a fair amount of tumbling and whatnot. But considering Warwick Davis's place in, you know, his subsequent career, he feels kind of wasted in this because, of course, he would go on to be, you know, he would be Willow, you know, the star of that Lucas fantasy film. He would be the Leprechaun in the Leprechaun horror films. He was in the Harry Potter movies playing various, I think, goblin creatures. So he has all these other roles, sometimes not even playing a magical being, just playing a person. You know, he has proven himself to be, a good actor, a solid actor. So it's interesting to watch this and know that he's, you know, there's this future acting talent just sealed in this suit.
I mean, he does a lot more with this role than you would expect to be possible because, to be fair, Wicket, there's not much on the page for Wicket in this story. If we were watching it, Rachel commented halfway through the movie, Wicket is a yes man. And that is absolutely true. Wicket mostly in this film is just there to be like, yes, 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 yes.
Yes, yes, this is true. But he also is kind of like he has his Jack Burton moment at the end because he comes through.
Oh, yeah.
When it's needed, he comes through.
Oh, yeah.
Well, he comes through more than once. There are a few times where he proves himself, the fighting powerhouse of our adventuring party here.
Mm-hmm. So despite the scary glassy eyes and the lack of substance for the role on the page, I think Warwick Davis does a great job playing Wicket in this.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, another person of note in this film is the witch, Charles, I believe her name is, played by Sian Phillips, probably the most seasoned actor in the whole production. She's a Welsh actor, probably best known for playing Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Moham in David Lynch's Dune. Wow. You remember her?
Oh, yeah. You will feel my Gam Jabbar.
Yeah. Yeah, she's fabulous in Dune. A weird movie we should probably come back to, because even if you strip away the Dune in Dune, there's plenty of just additional Lynchian weirdness in that film.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, she's great in that. She was also in I, Claudius. She played Cassiopeia in Clash of the Titans. And she also just did a ton of British TV work, seemingly, you know, most of it historical sort of stuff.
So I have a question about this character. She shows up, she's wearing like a metal corset, and she looks kind of like, there's a character in Mortal Kombat who she kind of reminds me of. I'm not quite sure what she was called, but she's got like long hair and she's evil.
Well, confusingly, the character you're thinking of in Mortal Kombat is Sindel.
Which is also the name of
the
child
of the little girl.
Movie.
Yeah. Sindel. Okay. Sindel is the girl. Sindel is the evil version in Mortal Kombat.
Okay. But yeah, so she looks kind of like that, but then she's a witch. Like she has sorceress powers. And so that makes me wonder, in the context of Star Wars, does that mean she is a force user?
Yes. So,
okay.
Yeah. So this is where it gets complex and geeky again, because within the context of this film alone and its time, she just seems to be a magical witch thrown in.
Yeah.
She's the witch of Endor. Get it? You know, biblical.
Oh, yeah, exactly. But, so she should be calling up the prophet Samuel to give an omen for the battle.
I guess so. I mean, it's kind of what she does. That's kind of her role here. We can sort of see the inspiration here. But subsequently, it has been retconned, I think, to understand that she was a rogue knight sister. So knight sisters are female practitioners of the force, female force-sensitive individuals who use the dark side and are capable of great magic in many cases. They're native to the planet Dathomir, which is also the planet that Darth Maul's species comes from. And basically in the Clone Wars animated series, and I think some in Rebels, I don't recall exactly, mainly in Clone Wars, we see these Night Sister characters showing up and playing an important role, and at times working with or working against the interests of the Sith.
But
so they're...
Well, she's got powers that no other Force user ever has in Star Wars. Like, she can transform into animals. Anakin Skywalker couldn't do that. Even I don't think Yoda could transform into an animal.
No, I mean, this is, but it does feel in keeping with Night Sister magic. Like the stuff that the Night Sisters do in the Clone Wars series are more like straight up magic, you know, like bringing things back to life, necromantic acts, that sort of thing. That being said, I do admit, like in this film, she feels like something other than the Force, even if she's ultimately using the Force.
I don't recall anybody in this film mentioning the Force. You wouldn't know the Force exists.
Right. Yeah. She's like a straight up witch in this film. And I say that Phillips isn't given a ton to do with this role, but she's good. I would have liked to have seen more from her character, but she plays a great witch. She has a really awesome costume and the effects are really nice when she transforms into a raven, because she already has like a raveny feathery cloak and all. And she has this magic ring that seems to, contain the magic she uses or focuses the magic she's using. We're not sure, but it plays an important role later on in the film.
So she's one of the main villains, but then the other main villain is the leader of these marauder aliens. When we were watching it, I kept calling him Thulsa Vroom. So he's the guy who leads the bad guys who show up at the village at the beginning and screw everything up. And he wants power, and he wants there's like a, I don't know how to explain the plot, but I guess we'll get into that in a minute. But there's this piece of technology from a spaceship that he wants because he thinks it'll give him power. So he's the same species as these other marauders, meaning he looks kind of like a reptilian, insect, orangutan, skeleton type creature, but also with certain angles, his silhouette and his facial hair, because he's got this cool beard, he looks like James Randi looked in the 80s. Did you notice this comparison? If you look at a picture of the Amazing Randi, like on Johnny Carson in the 70s or 80s, it's this guy. It's Tarek.
Huh. I didn't get that as much as I got kind of a faint, like, George C. Scott vibe from him.
Hmm. Oh, wow. That's a very different direction.
But, yeah, this is Tarek, the towering warlord of the Marauders. I also say that even though all the Marauders tend to look pretty good, clearly Tarek, when you're the ruler of a group of Marauders, you're going to get more screen time. Mm-hmm. You're also going to get more of that FX budget. Mm-hmm. So while sometimes the guys in the background look they look all right, Tarek looks really good. Like the makeup effects are really well done on him.
Yeah, I agree.
And he's played by the towering Dutch actor Carl Strucken, who went on to play Lurch in both 90s Addams Family movies, as well as the Giant on Twin Peaks. And he's been in a ton of stuff. And I think he did the voice of Tarek as well. I was looking at the credits to see if they were doing that thing where they have a different voice actor for a very physical role. But I think this is Strucken doing the voice as well, and it's his deep, giant voice, and it's quite effective.
You know where he really looks great, even better than in the movie, is in this poster you showed me for the movie that you found, where he's like holding a big sword. He's like the Darth Vader in the original Star Wars poster, towering over everything, looming in the background. Though I have to say also, and I know you pointed this out as well, this poster is extremely misleading about what's in this movie.
Yeah, and apparently this was like the home video version of the poster too. Like this was not just pre-production stuff. Like this, they were like, it's good, put it on the VHS and send it out. Because it does have a whole bunch of weird things that clearly show that it was created prior to the completion of the movie. Like, I don't know where to begin here. For instance, it has a giant Tarek. It's got multiple spaceships in the background, even though there's only ever one. It has
No space battles in this movie, but it makes it look like there's going to be.
Yeah. It also shows a Han Solo looking character with a blaster on the front that I think is supposed to be the dad from the first movie, but it makes no sense here because even the dad in this movie plays no real role.
Yeah, whoever this is not somebody in the movie.
Yeah, and then you have Wicket and Teek there standing battle ready, but then you have Sindel there holding a big old knife, like a big dagger, like she's ready to jump into combat and start stabbing marauders in the neck.
Mm-hmm. That is not indicative of what happens in the movie. And it looks like... I don't know. I wondered if also in this depiction, they're trying to make it more ambiguous that she might be a boy.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that too.
Like if they were like, oh, we need to make sure that boys want to watch this, so don't want to give them the impression that the main character is a girl.
I'm glad the Blurg made the cover too, though. The Blurg's in the background.
Yeah, totally. Pretty good. And there are these mountains that I don't recall being in the movie. These like snow-capped peaks. Is that in the film? Mm-hmm. I don't think so.
I don't remember any mountains, no.
There's like a cliff at one part, but I don't know. We can get into that. Okay, well, maybe we should just give a brief outline of the whole plot, so you know the shape of the thing. So we talked about how it starts, this Conan the Barbarian beginning, the village is raided, the humans, Sindel, the little girl. By the way, I don't know if I mentioned this already, but I had to look it up because they've got this actress named Aubrey Miller playing Sindel, the main character, the blonde girl, and clearly they wanted Drew Barrymore, right? This came out two or three years after E.T., and they were like, let's get Drew Barrymore, but maybe they couldn't afford her or something. So they were like, well, get us the Barrymorest kid you can find. And I think that's how we ended up with this main character here.
You know, there's apparently a fan theory that Sindel grows up to be Captain Phasma from the sequel trilogy.
What?
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing canon or anything here, but some fans put that together, and I think they what's her name, Gwendolyn Christie?
Yeah, she's also blonde. Okay,
yeah, they was like, yeah, they're both blonde. Maybe the math works. I don't know. And also, this does seem like the kind of experience that might harden you towards a life serving the First Order. So it kind of makes sense. I don't know.
Oh, right. So the idea is she's exposed to these roving bands of marauders. She's like, it's just chaos out here. We need order. We need order. So she's just like, sign up with the Empire, try to bring law and order to Endor.
Yeah, this traumatic experience. Yeah, and what direction are you going? She ends up going that direction. So I don't know. I don't think anybody's gone so far as to do a treatment of that in novel form or anything, or short story form, but it would be interesting to see how that might be stitched together.
Yeah. Okay. That's very interesting. Now my mind is set on it. So Sindel, her human family, they're living with the Ewoks. They're Paul Gleason, her dad, is working on this spaceship trying to repair it or something. And then they get attacked by the marauders, and then just all the humans except Sindel are killed. And so the leader of the bad guys, Thulsa Vroom, he obviously wants some kind of canister from out of Paul Gleason's spaceship. And when he tries to get it, and he's like, the power, I have the power. And then this is also where we meet the sorceress. And then Sindel and her Ewok buddies are captured by the marauding creatures. And Wicket promises to take care of her. He says, Wicket, take care of Sindel. So he speaks in the third person and invokes his own name. He's like a very cute teddy bear Bob Dole. And then the Ewoks escape the marauders who have captured them. Wicket and Sindel get away. And this movie very much continues on the theme that's established in The Return of the Jedi, that while the Ewoks may look extremely cute and like living teddy bears, they are also highly resourceful jungle guerrilla warriors. They're like the Viet Cong of Endor. They know how to use the environment. They set traps. You know, they've got very clever tactics for the landscape.
Yeah, when they are fighting on their own terms, on their home turf, they just can't be beat. They can take out the Galactic Empire as long as they're fighting within the forest of Endor and using guerrilla tactics.
Yes. So Wicket and Sindel escape, and this escape sequence involves what appears to be teleportation. Do you remember this part where they're just running through the woods, and then it just cuts to them most of the way up a cliff face? I don't know if something was edited out there, or if they're like, people get the point.
It feels like that was this cut for time a little bit there, yeah. But it's otherwise a great escape sequence, because there's like this, you know, they cut a hole through the bottom of this cart. Mm-hmm. They have this cart that's being pulled by a Blurg, and the cart seems to be made out of Blurg bones and hide. Mm-hmm. So I always like that. And yeah, then they're on the run, and two marauders are after them, and they manage to like duck into a cave, and like Wicket basically like straight up like murders the two marauders that are after them. Like well, no, I guess he doesn't. I think the marauders, through their own reckless violence, manage to dislodge some boulders that then fall on them and, you know, make them fall to their deaths.
Yeah, that's right. They get knocked off of the pass of Caradhras.
Yeah. Then they encounter a dragon condor, and they have to battle that, and she gets snatched away by it.
Yeah, they go into a cave, and is Wicket trying to build a hang glider? I think he's just building one out of bones and hides and stuff. Very cool.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing to keep in mind about the Ewoks. Like, yes, they're using, like, Stone Age technology, but they have mastered non-powered flight. Mm-hmm. Like, they can build a functional glider and just go for it.
Yeah, so he builds that, and then they accidentally disturb a dragon. What is the deal with this dragon's chest? It looks like it's wearing a vest of some kind. Do you remember this?
I don't remember the chest of the dragon. I mainly just remember it's, you know, it has kind of like a snaky condor-y head.
Uh-huh. Well, okay, so the dragon grabs Sindel and flies off with her, and then Wicket has to rescue her, which he does by, like, making the dragon drop her and then flying down and catching her after she's been dropped in a very physically implausible scene. But it works, and, you know, it's fun.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I noted, this maybe extremely brief monster science note, when they watch the dragon flying away, there's this part where they show a planet looming over the horizon, and it takes up literally half the sky. I guess that's supposed to be the gas giant that this moon is a moon of.
Yeah.
But I was like, that just looks too big. That is implausibly big. Though, it did make me look up, and I think we've sort of talked about this on the show before when we were talking about the moons of Jupiter, but there are moons you could stand on in our solar system where if you look at the planet that this is a moon of, the planet would look much bigger than things we're used to seeing in the sky. For example, if you stand on the surface of the innermost major moon of Jupiter, the Galilean moon Io, which is very yellow, sulfurous hell, lots of volcanoes erupting all the time. You stand on the surface of Io and you look at Jupiter. Jupiter would not take up half the sky, but it would be very big compared to like stuff we're used to seeing, like the sun or the moon. You can usually, I think, cover up the moon if you extend your arm fully and you can like cover it up with one finger. To cover up Jupiter from the surface of Io, you'd probably have to use your whole hand. So it's bigger, but it's still not the whole sky.
Right. I guess I didn't notice as much. Maybe I didn't think about it. But I've been playing this game No Man's Sky a little bit.
Oh yeah, that's fun.
Fun, beautiful game. You're exploring planets, landing on it. But there's a lot of that in this game.
Yes,
where you land on some strange, beautiful world, and the horizon is just redonkulous.
Yeah,
like gorgeous. But yeah, if you start thinking about the relative size and distances involved, it's a bit much at times.
But so Wicket and Sindel, they're out in the woods here after they've escaped, and then they meet the real star of the film, which is a tricksy beast with scruffy fur and beaver teeth that runs on fast forward, and this is Teek, who we've already alluded to. Teek is just the best.
Teek is, he's awesome. My wife thinks he has frightening teeth.
Yeah.
I don't think he is frightening. He's very rabbit-like, both in his dental mechanics, but also in just his overall form.
Mm-hmm.
He's this kind of like little rabbity fella that runs around at speeds that must make him the fastest creature in the Star Wars universe.
Mm-hmm. Here's the real question. Is Teek an Ewok?
I don't think so. No, I look, according to Wikipedia, his species is Teek. So
maybe the new season of The Mandalorian will have a baby Teek.
Oh, man, I would love for Teek to show up again in some form or another, because I feel like he was an absolute joy. It's, you know, very much it's an interesting story with Teek, because it's very much a little person in a suit, very well done, very well acted. The suit is in the puppetry that moves the facial features is just very well done.
Mm-hmm.
I totally bought Teek as an actual creature in this, but some of the lore apparently is that Wilford Brimley apparently can be difficult to get along with. And for starters, I don't think he liked the directors on this. And so somebody else had to direct him in all of his scenes. But on top of this, Teek was going to originally be either exclusively a puppet or was going to be a puppet more of the time. And Wilford was just having none of this. He's like, I'm not acting opposite a puppet. You get a person in here in a suit. I'll act against a person. But get that puppet out of here.
That's just perfect. Will, he's like, puppet, that's witchcraft. You know, he doesn't like it at all. But anyway, this alludes to the fact that the Teek and Wilford Brimley are a duo in this movie. Teek leads mm-hmm. Sindel and Wicket the Ewok to the home of Wilford Brimley. Again, the character's name is Noah. And we meet Wilford Brimley, and he's very ornery, and he tries to send them away. He's like, you can't stay here. Get out of my house. And the little girl's just like, well, he's just a mean old man anyway. But he makes them depart the kingdom of Brimley. So they sit outside being sad and pathetic. They're like, we're cold, we're hungry. And he's like, well, I'm a mean old man and I don't care. But then his heart, with some urging from Teek, his heart eventually melts and he lets them into the house and they share mm-hmm. a fire. And then he becomes nice grandpa instead of mean grandpa.
Yeah, I was watching this movie with my son and he was initially not having any of this this Noah character. Is like, yeah, this guy's awful. He's mean. I don't like him. But then he has a rapid change of heart. And then he's all in for the rest of the movie.
Speaking of the resourcefulness of the Ewoks, one of the things that I really enjoyed was there's a scene where Wicket makes a fire with a bow drill.
Yeah. It's weird. The domestic scenes in this film are some of my favorites. Like, they just warm my heart in a way that I can't fully explain. But just the scenes where they're just sitting around eating or cooking or playing music together. Mm-hmm. Like, these are just, I don't know, they're just totally warm experiences.
Yeah.
I think I like those more than anything else.
There's a lot of puppets eating food, or I don't know if I guess the facial puppetry of Teek and stuff, that I guess that would still be puppetry. Even though there's an actor playing Teek, but like there's the scene where they're eating a pie made out of flowers. I didn't fully understand that. Like, they gathered flowers, they're mm-hmm. like, we're making a pie, and okay. But then so after all this, you get these nice domestic scenes, they share a fire, they eat flower pie, and then we finally cut to the Castle of Pain. It shows these stone towers. I don't know what castle they used to film this at, but it's this nasty castle where the skeleton orangutan insect creatures live, and the raven sorceress is there, and they're all hanging out trying to do some kind of magic spell on the canister mm-hmm. from Paul Gleason's spaceship. I didn't really understand this either, but maybe it wasn't supposed to make sense.
I don't know. I probably thought about it way too much, because I think what we have here is that the Marauders at some time in the past themselves crash landed on Endor. Mm-hmm. And at this point, they no longer, I suspect that the Marauders were like more of a primitive society on their home world. Like, maybe they had achieved, you know, like Iron Age or maybe Bronze Age technology before they got sucked up into galactic affairs, you know, forced to be a warrior caste by some group or another, and just thrown in over their head, given technology that they don't really understand, but figure out how to use effectively, like the blasters that they have, you know, that are all just, again, held together with dirty gauze. There are a couple of scenes of one of them sitting around drunkenly tinkering with some sort of electrical contraption and electrocuting itself in the process. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you get that sense that they sort of know how the technology works. They know it well enough to use it, but they don't understand other concepts. So at some point in their past, they might have understood that they need a power cell to give them the power to return to orbit and return to galactic affairs. But at this point, you know, maybe it's generations afterwards, all that has survived is this idea that if they get a hold of a power cell, that is the power.
Okay.
And so Tarek believes that he no longer understands it in terms of technological power, but in terms of like personal cosmic power, personal magical power.
Through the decay of the lore over the years, what was initially a technological utilitarian need has become a religion. We need this object of power in order to give us basically the magic to do what we want.
Right. And as far as the castle goes, I interpreted that as being like ruins that they found. Like, those are the ruins of some, even, you know, some previous Endorian civilization that was snuffed out or expired.
Okay. Yeah, I guess that would make sense.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So they're trying to work their magic, and it's not going well. And then we cut back to Wilfred Brimley, Sindel, and Wicked, and Teak, and they're in the actually, they find out that Wilfred Brimley himself has a crashed spaceship. Seems like there are a lot of crashed spaceships around here, and he's mm-hmm. been trying to repair it, right? He's like been working on it for all these years.
Yeah, basically. Again, the comparisons between this movie and No Man's Sky are tremendous, because you land on a planet in No Man's Sky, and they're just crashed spaceships everywhere. And that's kind of how it is here. Yeah, so he has a crashed spaceship, but he has been working to repair it, but he does not have a power cell.
In the process of discovering this, the characters just get more and more sappy toward each other. Wilfred Brimley gets all sweet, and he opens up to the child and the Ewok. He gets Sindel to sing a song at one point, and I don't mean to be mean to this child actor, but it is so bad. Like, Wicket can barely pretend to clap at the end of the song. Another thing I noticed so you mentioned that the cart made by the Marauder creatures looks like it's made out of bones, and you're right about that. Maybe it's made out of the Blurg bones. Sometimes Wilfred Brimley's hut in the woods also looks like it's made out of bones, like that Stone Age mammoth bone hut we talked about in an episode not too long ago.
Well, I mean, it seems like there are various megafauna on the planet that can be butchered and made into houses.
But it's the forest moon of Endor. They're not hurting for lumber.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, why? There's wood everywhere. Why build anything out of a bone?
Yeah, interesting. I wonder. But anyway, So one morning, you get the third act kicks into gear because one morning Sindel is lured out of the house by something that she thinks is the sound of her mother singing. And then Wicked and Wilfred Brimley go after her. And Sindel comes across this weird fairy-type lady in a flowing white dress who's out in the forest with a white horse. But, of course, it's a trap. This is the sorceress, the witch from the beginning. She snatches Sindel and rides off on a horse to the Castle of Pain.
Yeah, the horse turns black in the process.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And then Thulsa of Rhoom wants Sindel to use her magic to make the stolen canister work. And she, of course, doesn't know how to do this. And then he has a meltdown and throws her in a prison cell. But there's a rescue scene that kicks off. So Wilfred Brimley, Wicket, and Teak, they sort of gear up. And they go to the castle on a mission of rescue. There's a grappling hook infiltration. This whole infiltration scene with Teak, I think, is really fun.
It is. It's a lot of fun because you got the grappling hook going in. It's Teak is your stealth specialist, flying ahead. There's a wonderful scene where once they are inside, and just getting in is pretty exciting. But then they all three stack up on top of each other and put a cloak over themselves to pretend to be one marauder in order to pass unnoticed through their drunken mead hall.
Yeah. Well, the bad guys are doing this thing where, I guess this sometimes happens, especially in kids' movies, where the bad guys are all hanging out and they're having a big old feast and they're eating and drinking and they're just constantly emitting nonstop growling maniacal laughter. And it makes you wonder, like, yeah, what are they talking about? What's so funny? It's just nonstop.
Yeah. I don't know what they're talking about. I mean, clearly they're talking about, I mean, there's that one guy that's working with electrical equipment. Uh-huh. So maybe that's a lot of like insider techie humor on his end, but everybody else is just drinking and laughing.
Yeah. But then Wilfred Brimley, Wicket, and Teak free the Ewoks and Sindel from the castle prison. The escape sequence reveals that Ewoks, once again, they're pretty handy with blasters in a pinch. And everybody escapes via a zip line. And then they do the thing. that Kevin McAllister does in Home Alone, where the bad guys try to come on the zip line after them and they cut it so that they fall into the moat.
Yeah, the acid moat.
Oh, is it acid or does it have some kind of creature in it? I couldn't tell if it was supposed to be piranhas or if the liquid itself was harmful.
Oh, yeah, they're a little vague on that point.
There's something in there that bubbles and messes you up. Oh, and there's a great line. I love when they're reunited. So we find out that Wilfred Brimley had a friend that he crash landed on this planet with, and his bones are there in the Castle of Pain. And when Sindel and Wilfred Brimley meet back up, Sindel says to him, "I'm sorry about your friend. They killed him for the power thing."
And there is Sarek's bones, like just bones, just basically
a
high school science display. Yeah,
there's like really dry bones, like they look fossilized. So I don't know how long Wilfred Brimley's supposed to have been there, but yeah.
Now, and when they're freeing the Ewoks, an important thing is that there's a second there where the witch is locked up too. Mm-hmm. We've learned in all this that the witch is as much a prisoner as they are in many ways. Like Tarek keeps asking her to release the magic and she can't do it. And there's this confusing scene when they're still locked up where the witch is talking to Sindel and says, "Well, why didn't you release the magic when he asked you to release the magic? Did you try waving your hand over it or something?" And it's a confusing sequence that more than anything in this film forces me to do a lot of mental gymnastics to make work. Mm-hmm. Because if she's this magical being, where does she come from? Like the Night Sister excuse, like that seems to work for a lot of this. You can say, well, she's a force sensitive individual from another planet. Like everybody else in this scenario, she got stuck on this planet or got stuck with the Marauders at some point or another. But she clearly knows about spaceships. That's revealed later. She I guess knows about a wider universe. So doesn't she realize this is a power cell? The best I can do to understand this is maybe she's just been in with the Marauders so long. She's gone mad. She's like bought into Tarek's madness into thinking that the power cell has magical properties. I don't know.
That is an admirable retcon, Rob. You've come as close as a person could come.
Because otherwise, it's a real, I say it's a real weak point in this particular script. Yeah. But at any rate, Sindel refuses to let Wicket free her, says, no, she's evil, and swats the keys out of his hands, and they go down in the sewer. And then once the good guys have escaped, the marauders come back. They act for a second like they're just going to gun down the witch in the cage. But instead, they free her. And they're like, yeah, come with us, and we're gonna get this thing back. She transforms into her raven form, but after she does so, Tarek takes the magic ring off of the raven's claw there, and puts it on a necklace around his own neck. Presumably, this means she cannot change back into her human form until she gets that ring back from Tarek.
Oh, okay, I didn't understand that at the time. Now I do. That makes sense. But Tarek also seems to maybe – is he getting power from the ring or something? I don't know. Is it like the One Ring?
I don't think he gets anything out of it, okay. No. Until in the very final scene with him, he gets it in all the wrong ways, which we'll touch on.
So the Marauders then chase our heroes. They chase Wilford Brimley, Sindel, and the Ewoks, and Teek. And the heroes are going to – remember, Wilford Brimley has a spaceship that's up on cinder blocks in his yard. They're going to that, and Wilford Brimley is going to do something with the power cell. I think he's going to repair his ship, and I don't know, they'll escape or something. But there, of course, has to be an Ewok battle, just like in Return of the Jedi, and there is one. So the Ewoks battle the Marauders in the woods, and they use traps, and they use the environment, and it's much like the Return of the Jedi scene.
Yeah, it's Marauders versus Ewoks. And it's pretty good. Lots of traps going off. And then eventually, Noah gets the ship's defenses running. So he starts busting out. First of all, there's like this enormous blaster cannon on the side of the ship that like folds out and starts taking down enemies. And then there are also these two what seem to be open air gunnery positions. Mm-hmm. Like they're not completely enclosed. So either that's a flaw in the whole design, or they're only intended for use during, like, while the ship is in an atmosphere or something. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, they've got, like, three gunnery positions now, I think, adding to the use of traps. And they have a catapult, which, of course, ends up firing an Ewok at a Marauder at one point.
Right.
Teek gets in on the action. There's a wonderful scene where he starts a little fire underneath one of the Blurg's feet starts a Blurg stampede. Mm-hmm.
I mean, since he is essentially the Flash, you would think he would be pretty useful in a fight. He can, like, fast-forward run to any position.
Oh, yeah. Then he wraps – he fast-forward vine wraps a Marauder to mm-hmm. a tree at one point.
Yes. There are lots of vines. That also makes me think about how the spaceship is not only – so the spaceship that's up on cinder blocks is covered in vines. They look very flammable. When they start shooting the lasers, it looks like – I don't know. It looks like a fire hazard. But, of course, as you might expect, it's a yub-nub. The humans and the Ewoks win the battle against the Marauders, and yay. But then the bad guy, Tarek, he, even after the battle is over, he captures Sindel, and he tries to bargain with Wilford Brimley. He's like, give me the power, defy me, and she is doomed. And then Wilford Brimley and Thulsa Vroom duel. So it's sword versus walking stick. And for a second, it looks like Tarek is going to win, but then Wicket uses his sling and hits, I guess, the jewel on the ring on Tarek's necklace that he got from the witch. And for some reason, hitting that with the sling or the stone from the sling makes Tarek get just crispified. He just sort of like burns up and turns into a ash husk.
Yeah, it's a great petrification scene because it's like it hits the ring and then Tarek has this moment. You know, he's wanted power this whole time. He wants magical power. And now he's gotten it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not from the source he was after, but here's the power. And it just fries him like
charbroiled.
Charbroiled. Like you just put him in the microwave too long, just turns him to this smoking ashen stone. And it's a pretty great sequence. And then afterwards, like the Wicket's trying to get too close to it, and Noah's like, don't even look at it. Don't get close to it. It's just like just an unwholesome affair.
It doesn't taste as good as he smells. but then, of course, they fly away. Wilford Brimley and Sindel evacuate the planet. Sindel is now a child of space, and I don't know what happens after that. Maybe they go on adventures, or maybe Sindel joins the Empire.
Yeah, like that would make sense if you go the Captain Phasma direction. I think they were going to do a third one of this. I've seen rumblings about that, that originally there was going to be a third Ewok movie, but it never came to fruition. So one can only wonder.
And so that's the end. Yub nub, yub nub.
I can't. Does Teek stay behind, or does Teek go too?
I don't remember. I should know that.
I think Teek stays. I think Teek is a child of Endor, like the Ewoks, and should not leave.
If Teeks had been made to fly, they would have been born with power cells.
Yeah. Also, what happens if Teek is on board a ship traveling at warp speed, and then he runs at full speed back through the hallways?
Oh, that's one of those good relativity questions. Man, I wish I'd thought of this ahead of time. We could have worked that out.
That's homework. Homework for your listeners who want to do some deep thinking there. So in terms of, deep thinking about this one, again, I think my main area of contemplation is just about the role of different species at different technological levels within the galactic community of Star Wars. Because just in this film, just think of all the different technological levels we encounter. Like there are the Ewoks, which again seem to have just peak Stone Age technology at their hands.
Uh-huh.
We have the Marauders, who again probably didn't have a tremendous technological achievement level before they were seemingly thrust into galactic affairs. So you almost I pity the Marauders, because how much say did they have in the current state of their species? You have the possible medieval level technology that we see in that castle of some, I guess, forgotten or extinct species that may have lived on Endor at one point.
Mm-hmm.
You've got people like Sindel's family and Noah, who are part of the spacefaring community at large, but having crash landed, having lost some of their technology, are well on their way towards just being, living at a lower level of technological achievement. Like Noah has become an old man in a hut cooking over fires instead of a spacefaring adventurer.
Well, this makes me wonder if maybe Endor at the time of the Star Wars movies is in a dark age, kind of like after the late Bronze Age collapse, where you'd had these big empires that were developing urban centers and trade and technology, and then something happens, some kind of environmental collapse. Maybe there's a collapse of a confluence of different factors, military invasions, famine, and that kind of stuff that leads to civilization level collapse. And then a lot of knowledge of how to do things is just lost.
Yeah. And who knows, the Marauders may have played some role in that, either as, as a faction or, mercenaries who were brought in to be a part of this, this situation. And of course, eventually the Galactic Empire itself does show up. They show up in Return of the Jedi, but they have a very strategic and surgical interest in the moon of Endor. Like they seem to be only interested in establishing a shield generator base to protect the second Death Star, which is being built within that system. Otherwise, I don't think they particularly care what the Ewoks are doing. They don't care if there happened to be a band of Marauders on the other side of the moon doing their thing. They don't care if there's some other random shipwrecked individuals. They have a task to take care of. So anyway, that's some additional stuff I was thinking about, as well as just wondering how fast Teek is in relation to everything else. I will say that this, of course, is a topic that gets a lot better treatment in other works. It's part of the whole Prime Directive thing in Star Trek. I know Ian M. Banks gets into this a fair amount in his culture novels. It's, once you start populating a fictional galactic community with different species at different technological levels and then interacting with each other, you're going to get a lot of these questions, and a lot of the reason I think that we contemplate that is, of course, we see examples of similar interplays having happened on our own planet in human history. What happens when when one more technologically advanced society interacts with another one? Typically, it's not a good situation, especially for the lower technological level society. But you see some interesting scenarios happening, such as the cargo cult scenario that we mentioned previously on the Stuff to Blow Your Mind episode in our interview with Werner Herzog. The idea of people encountering
a higher technological level society, a higher technological system, and then being changed by that, but also surviving that encounter as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's a lot of deeper thinking here to consider in terms of varied technological level interaction in a galactic community.
Really, don't we all just want the power? We all just want the power thing. That's the human power condition. Thing, yeah. Give me the power thing.
All right. Well, in terms of where to watch this film, I really wish I could tell everybody that you can just sign up for Disney Plus and watch a nice remastered cut of both Ewok movies alongside all the other awesome Star Wars content there. But the thing is, you can't. Yeah, you can't get it on Disney Plus. I think you can still pick these films up on DVD in a cool double pack. I was looking around, and you can buy them. And some of the prices are not unreasonable if you know where to look. But I had to watch this on Russian YouTube, so that sadly might be your only option.
Yeah, as long as we're admitting bootleg experiences, I watched this movie a while ago on one of those versions that tries to avoid copyright detection by like putting it in a window within a window and having like fish swimming around it all the time and weirdly zooming in and moving on stuff. So kudos to the people who put that amount of effort in to steal movies.
But I mean, check around when you're listening to this, hopefully, but if you're listening to this like months later, Disney Plus will have added these films. I hope that they do, or that some other legitimate means of watching it will be available. I think point,
give us
they
a way
were
to
on
pay
Amazon
for it.
Prime. Yeah. I mean, I would have bought these suckers earlier if I could. So yeah, good luck finding it. But it people want it enough that it's going to continue to be available one way or another. Hopefully, legitimately available in the near future. All right. Well, on that note, we're going to go ahead and finish up this episode of Weird House Cinema. Weird House Cinema is our special Friday episode. Our core episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind are still very much science and culture, and those are still publishing on Tuesdays and Thursdays. This is a little extra fun that you get at the end of the week to listen to if you want, or you can skip them, or you can note what the movie is, go watch the movie, come back. There are multiple ways to enjoy Weird House Cinema or not. Of course, we want to hear from you. Are you enjoying what we're doing here? Do you have recommendations for the future? But especially if you have thoughts on the Ewok movies, particularly The Battle for Endor. Did you watch it as a kid like I did? Did you have a well-worn VHS copy of it? I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, your thoughts about how it fits into the broader Star Wars universe. Everything is up for grabs.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.